Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. I'm your co-host, Joanne Chang, here in the studio with my co-host, Carissa Thorpe.
Hello.
Hi. And our new technician is Maniac Dan. Welcome to Animal Voices, Maniac Dan.
Hey.
And
good to be here.
Good to have you. And I just want to say thank you for John Pranger for all his hard work as our technician in the past past 10 months, and of course for many years before that, before we had started. And John had wanted to take a break a long time ago, and finally now he can. So John, if you're listening, have a good time off. And, of course, Allison is not here with us. She is on vacation in L.A. Allison seems to take a vacation once every few months, and right now she's rubbing shoulders with Leonardo DiCaprio and Weird Al Yankovic. So I don't think she's listening to us or thinking of us much.
But she is lucky.
Oh, yes, yes. She has some great stories to tell about celebrities. And, well, when she comes back, I'm sure she'll give us some travel reviews of vegan food over in LA. So on today's show, we have Matt Allerbeck, who is a piranha conservationist. He is from Ontario, and as our listeners may remember, he was on our show a few months ago talking about snakes, but now he wants to educate us about piranhas and why we should protect them. And on the second half of the hour, we have Marianne Sullivan. She is a lawyer and a professor and the president of the New York City-based nonprofit Our Hen House, and she will be talking to us about the state of animal rights law in the U.S. and around the world. So, Carissa, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. You think you're ready for the news?
I think so.
Awesome.
Okay. So, the BCSPCA is expressing strong disappointment in the light sentence given to Armstrong residents Sandra and Jim Tullett after the couple was convicted of animal cruelty in a Vernon court last week. On July 16, 2008, BCSPCA animal cruelty investigators seized several animals from a roadside petting zoo north of Vernon that was being operated by the couple. There were hundreds of animals on the site, and we issued numerous orders for the Tullets to improve conditions for the animals, said Constable Kathy Woodward, Senior Animal Protection Officer for the BCSPCA. Despite these orders, we determined on a follow-up visit that several animals were in distress and obtained a warrant to seize them. Constables took two pot-bellied pigs, two turtles, and a fennec fox into custody and issued additional orders to improve conditions for many of the remaining animals on the property. On August 31st, the Tullets were found guilty of animal cruelty and sentenced to a $250 fine each, 6 months probation, and were allowed to keep all of the animals currently in their care.
Oh my God, $250.
Yeah, so $500, and you can just abuse animals
and
as much as you want.
They don't take them away. They just say, give us $500 and continue abusing them.
Yeah, it sounds great.
That makes a lot of sense. I hope whoever takes that $500 is enjoying themselves.
Yeah, it says here that they have a large number of animals, including horses, cats, sheep, goats, chickens, ducks, ferrets, exotic birds, and a dog, according to Woodward.
Oh my God.
That sounds like a lot of opportunity to continue. Like,
yeah.
What does $500 teach you?
It's a slap on the wrist. It's nothing. It's like, you know, how much you pay for, I don't know, like half of your rent.
Yeah.
Jeez. That's great. I guess that sends a strong message to animal abusers that you can just abuse animals, just pay up $500.
Mm-hmm. In addition to the lack of consequences for the couple, Marcy Moriarty, General Manager of Cruelty Investigations, said the light sentence places further strain on the BCSPCA's limited resources. Our cruelty investigations work is funded entirely by donations, and we have already spent numerous hours issuing orders and making follow-up visits to ensure that the Tullets are making proper care of their animals. She said, the court has allowed them to keep large numbers of animals, which means the BCSPCA will have to expend additional resources to monitor the situation so that further neglect does not occur. The potbelly pigs were seized by the BCSPCA in the Tullet case were suffering from a number of welfare issues, including badly grown hooves and untreated eye infections. Oh. The fennec fox, a small desert dweller native to the Sahara, was kept in a poorly lit and poorly ventilated enclosure and was in poor health. He was extremely thin, appears to have internal parasites, and was exhibiting abnormal behavior, such as a constant shaking of the head, said Woodward. Normally found in social groups, the fox was housed alone in an isolated enclosure. The seized turtles were being kept in a filthy aquarium with no filtration system. The water in the murky aquarium was deep, and there were no perches for the turtles to rest upon to enable them to breathe above the water. So, that doesn't sound like they were...
No, and this is a roadside petting zoo?
Yeah.
So people were going to visit these sick animals?
Yeah.
Wow, interesting.
I don't know. I don't like zoos in general, but when you see conditions like that...
Yeah, I have questions about people that would pay to go visit sick animals like that. That's just kind of disturbing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and my other news story here is just 1 week after PETA released the results of its shocking undercover investigation at the North Carolina Contracted Animal Testing Facility Professional Laboratory and Research Services Incorporated, which uncovered workers' appalling abuse and neglect of dogs, cats, and rabbits tormented in tests for flea and tick products. They filed a 70-page formal complaint with the U.S. Department of Agriculture alleging violations of the Animal Welfare Act. PLRS is shutting its doors for good and surrendering more than 200 dogs and cats left in the facility to animal shelters.
Wow.
So that's some good news.
Yeah. When does that ever happen, right? Yeah. Like, those labs never go down.
Yeah. PETA is hailing it as an historic victory for animals, and their investigation revealed that dogs, cats, and rabbits abused by PLRS suffered from untreated illnesses, injuries, and burns, that many animals were covered with sores that were likely caused by poor housing, stress, and boredom. PETA's investigator also documented that the employees kicked through, grabbed, dropped, and dragged dogs, roughly grabbed and lifted rabbits by their ears, and violently threw and slammed cats into cages.
And that really helps them discover the perfect flea product, I guess.
Yeah.
Are they gonna pay to have all these animals placed? I mean, they should be somehow responsible
for
all these animals.
I don't know. It didn't say that, but I definitely agree.
Yeah. So I guess all these animals are being released to good hands, I guess?
Yeah, they're being sent to animal shelters, and they're going to be taken care of. They're going to get the veterinary care that they've been lacking. But who's going to pay for that?
Right. Exactly. Not the lab, obviously.
Probably not.
No.
Well, that's all that I have for the news.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that, for the news. And that last one was definitely a very exciting piece. Yeah. So you have been listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. And I think we have our next guest on the line. So, Carissa, before we go on, I want to ask you, what do you think of when I say piranhas? That's what you think.
It sounds like they're going to eat my legs off.
Is that what you think?
Yeah.
Well, our first guest is going to tell us a very different story about piranhas. Matt Allerback, as some of our listeners may remember, was on our show not so long ago advocating for the protection of snakes. Matt is a conservationist, animal advocate, and has now ventured into another area of conservancy, and this time he is advocating for the protection of piranhas. Matt, welcome to Animal Voices.
Well, thanks so much for having me back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. You always teach us so much about these animals that we fear and don't know much about.
Absolutely, and that's something that has always really been important to me, sort of advocating for, you know, some of the animals that don't usually get attention, or the attention that they do get is very, very negative.
Yeah. So, yeah, we've heard all about piranhas, mostly in horror movies, and I don't think many people have ever seen piranhas in the wild. I certainly haven't. So, for starters, can you tell us, where in the world do they live?
Piranhas are found in rivers and waterways throughout the tropical portions of South America.
Mm. Okay. And just in South America, they don't live anywhere else?
No, that's the only spot in the world where they can be found.
Awesome. And, well, in movies, again, unfortunately, that's where most people get their education about piranhas. These animals do nothing all day but sit around in water waiting for a human to fall in, and then they chomp them up.
And then it's a skeleton.
Yes. But we know this can't be true, right? They have their own life to live. They can't just be waiting for a human to fall in. So can you tell us a little bit about how these creatures live, breed, feed, and who preys on them?
Yeah. Well, piranhas are very shy creatures and spend a lot of their times in loosely organized schools, depending on the species. And that's more for protection, not for hunting. So they group together because they're actually scared of other animals. And there's so much about them that we don't know because they are very secretive. A lot of their breeding habits are unknown. But what we do know about them is that despite their image as these carnivorous, murderous fish, their diets are more complex. A lot of piranhas are largely vegetarians, in fact. Only a small number of species have ever been involved in incidents with attacks on humans. And those have had very specific circumstances leading up to them. As you said, it's not like they wait around all day waiting for people to bite. And they do have a number of different predators throughout their habitats, such as river otters, dolphins, and caimans, which are kind of crocodilians. So they have a lot of different predators out there, and that's why they group together for protection. So they're more of a shy, wary animal than most people would realize.
Wow, interesting. I would never think of that. How big are they, anyway?
Well, that depends on the species. Most piranhas range between 7 to 11 inches long. The largest species is probably the black piranha, and they can get up to 18 inches long. So a decent-sized fish, but, you know, nothing like a shark or, you know, a large catfish. Certainly there's a predatory fish species out there that are much bigger than piranhas are.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say there are various species. Are there some distinctions between the species?
Well, first off, I should mention that, you know, as I said before, there's so much about them that scientists don't know, and even the number of species is debated. But what we think is there's around 30 to 60 different piranha species throughout the tropical portions of South America, and these differ in their lifestyles, what they eat, their visual morphology, their behavior, their size, and things like that. But they all are riverine fish that like, you know, tropical temperatures.
Mm-hmm. Like most of all creatures on this planet, and especially those ones we fear, the biggest threat to piranhas are humans. Can you tell us what humans are doing to threaten piranhas?
Piranhas are largely threatened by people because every year a large amount of these fish are unfortunately kidnapped out of their natural habitats, and then they're either sent off to pet stores all the way around the world. And I think it's very unfair to kidnap an animal from the wild and force it to live in captivity. Some of them are dried out and killed, and then these piranhas are mounted or encased in glass and then sold as ornaments. Why someone would want a dead animal as an ornament is beyond me, but it happens, sadly. Some of them are sent off to food markets. So they're kidnapped from their homes and then killed or exploited in various ways.
Mm-hmm. And people eat them, you said?
Yeah, they are largely caught in different fish traps and gills net and sometimes just hook and line for food. And other people, you know, like people who go sport hunting do just like to fish for them for, you know, the gimmick of it all because, again, people think they're scary, then they get this idea in their head that, you know, whatever makes them a man or whatever mentality is going on where they want to go out and then hunt these perceived dangerous animals.
So what's the scale of, say, the pet trade and you know, mounting them as ornaments? Is that, do we kill a lot of them for those purposes?
A lot of them are killed, yes. The exact figures, excuse me, are hard to come by. Mm-hmm. Again, there's so very little we know, and I think that makes their protection even that more valid. If we don't know exactly what we're doing, then we really shouldn't be going out and doing it. Not that we should be exploiting animals anyway, but the opposition for these things that I hear time and time again through certain conservationists is all these practices are regulated and it's sustainable, which I don't buy anyway in all other cases. But even more concerning is this time we don't even know what the numbers are. So, you know, what right do people have to go into nature and just pillage it and take what they want and really have no idea what sort of serious consequences they could be causing?
Mm-hmm. Now, are they endangered or threatened in any way?
They're not listed on any official list mm-hmm. as a threatened or endangered species, but again, you know, from an animal rights standpoint, I think the large amount of exploitation and cruelty they receive, like just to go out and hunt something because you think is dangerous, is very cruel to me. Nothing deserves to be killed just because we have these ideas about them, or and certainly nothing deserves to be kidnapped and then thrown in a glass box and or killed just so we can make a tacky ornament out of it. So I think, you know, from an animal rights standpoint, the issues that piranhas face are very, very cruel, and that's why I'm so passionate about standing up for them.
Mm-hmm. Do we import a lot of piranhas in Canada or in the U.S.?
Well, just from where I live, and I live in a fair-sized city in Kingston, Ontario, mm-hmm. we have about four or five pet stores in the region, and all of them carry piranhas. Mm. So you can imagine in bigger cities, that's probably even more so going on. And when things like horror movies come up, there's been right. a surge, and I was talking to some of the pet store owners for information. They said that since the movies come out, they've had a hard time keeping them in stock, so then even more piranhas are being harvested now because, you know, again, these people get these ideas in their head that, oh, it's cool and dangerous, so now I want to have one.
Right, and it's something that people normally don't think about, but when you said they're in every pet store, then that's a huge number.
And that's just in my area, and that's a very right. small area, so you can imagine across the country in larger cities like Vancouver or Toronto or right. Ottawa, it's probably even more so prevalent.
Right. Now, I don't know much about piranhas, but I'm guessing Hollywood is probably largely responsible for piranhas having the reputation as vicious human-killing fish. But I also know that this reputation of piranhas is more prevalent throughout the world. For instance, in my native language, which is Mandarin, the common term for piranhas literally means man-eating fish. And while doing some research, I found that there's Brazilian folklore that says that piranhas can devour a whole cattle in minutes. So why do you think they have this reputation? Is there any truth in any of this?
There has been reported piranha attacks. I'm not going to say that they're a completely harmless animal because they can be potentially dangerous. However, I think it's unfair for us to stigmatize an animal and, you know, give it, say it's a murderous monster just because we don't understand it. The instances where piranha attacks have occurred have usually had various other factors going into them which have triggered the attacks. For instance, most piranha attacks on people happen either during the dry season where water levels are very, very low and you might have a large concentration of piranhas in an area where there isn't a lot of prey items. So then people entering the water where there are predatory animals in their natural environment in a small area mm-hmm. with very little to prey upon, they're just going to only act naturally and try to, you know, sustain themselves. So that could be an instance where an attack might happen. Another thing which can happen is these animals can become conditioned. There was a report done where there was a population of piranhas in a river system, and the overhanging vegetation had a lot of baby bird fledglings that would fall into the river, and they became so conditioned to eating this prey item that every time something hit the surface of the river, they immediately wanted to attack it. So swimming in a place like that mm-hmm. wouldn't exactly be a good idea. The other time that attacks attacks have occurred is, again, during certain parts of the seasons where the piranhas are actually breeding, and they will protect their spawning sites. And if you have a lot of people swimming, and the piranhas will actually swim over and defend their nest. But again, I don't think it's fair to stigmatize this as an evil animal. This is an animal that's either, you know, attacking, and I use that word loosely, because mm-hmm. it either is looking for food and trying to sustain itself, mm-hmm. or because it's trying to protect its offspring. So this is a loving creature that's trying to protect its babies. It's not a malicious animal. And the other thing people need to understand is, when we venture out into natural habitats where animals can live, that is their natural home. And when we invade that, we have to understand that these creatures may respond to our presence and may respond dangerously. So we need to, you know, people have monopolized so much of the natural world, and we've destroyed so much natural habitat, and a lot of animals don't have that many places left to live. And then when we go out and there are instances, it's very easy for us to chastise them as evil or nuisance or dangerous or pests and all these negative words, mm-hmm. when we really have to understand that we're going out to their homes and we should really give them the respect they deserve, not fear.
Mm-hmm. And I think I saw on your website that sometimes people get bitten because they're trying to catch them or something.
Yeah, a lot of bites happen when people are fishing for them, and they might be flopping around off the line just biting because they're scared. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you're more apt to be bitten by a piranha when fishing for them and handling them and fooling around with them than you are just swimming around.
Right. And I guess, can you tell us about piranha bites when it does happen? It's not like, do they just devour a whole person, or is it just like little bites?
A typical piranha bite will be sort of like a circular laceration.
Yeah.
And when they're protecting their spawning sites, that's usually what you're seeing. You're seeing a single bite by a fish. Sometimes they can take off whole, toes or fingers, and that's a severe bite. Other time you have mm-hmm. laceration wounds. So, I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, portray the piranha as a cuddly bunny rabbit. It's not. They are largely predators. They have extremely sharp teeth and will use them if need be. But again, we need to look at things more prospectively. People always like to think of themselves as the most intelligent and enlightened beings on Earth. Well, if we are, we should use that a little more to look at things from a different perspective. So, yes, they can be dangerous. They have very sharp teeth, some species, but again, doesn't mean they're evil necessarily.
Right.
And they're not a malicious creature that, you know, stalk humans at every chance.
And to comment about bunny rabbits, they have very sharp teeth and they do like to bite too. So
yes, I've been nipped by rabbits before. So
they could be like piranhas as well.
Maybe, yeah, there are parallels there.
Yeah. So, you know, what can regular people like us and our listeners do to protect piranhas?
Well, if people do go into pet stores or they come across any places that are selling piranhas, whether it be their fillets, whether it be those products I talked about, you can help out by first not buying the products, and I'm sure most listeners don't want to buy any animal products. But secondly, you can write in a letter to the store manager, because obviously there's probably not going to be any store that just specializes in selling just piranhas or piranha products. You can let them know that you're not going to support any store or industry that tries to profit off of exploiting and abusing animals. And being specific about piranhas is important, because I think if we can teach people the value in caring about and wanting to protect a carnivorous fish, which a lot of people think are scary, then I think, you know, you can teach them anything. I think by teaching them the value of one animal, you can sort of draw parallels and see that they're all worth something.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the popular horror movie Piranhas is due out on DVD any day now. If you had a chance to meet the producers of this movie, what would you say to them?
I don't think I can say that on the radio. No, I would probably say, first off, I mean, like, come on, could you not think of anything else? I mean, the Jaws and piranhas and all these, you know, horror movies about animals, it's been done to death. Couldn't you think of anything better? But I would commend them for at least using CGI piranhas and not using live animals in the movie. And I think that a lot of movies do use animals as props or gimmicks in their TV shows or movies, and that's not something I agree with. So I'll I'll give them credit for not using live piranhas in the movie, but they probably could have thought of something better.
Mm-hmm. And it would be good, I guess, it would be a nice project to convince, you know, people that make movies, maybe to put a you know, line or something in the end of the movie saying that, you know, advocating for piranhas or something like that.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is I wish viewers... The problem is, and what you said today is very true, that most people, their understanding of piranhas and other similar animals like snakes or sharks do, unfortunately, come from TV and movies. And we need to be a little more enlightened about what we watch and think, you know, not everything on TV is true. That's mm-hmm. what we tell, you know, parents tell their kids that. That's a monster. That's not real. It's just TV. Right. Well, sometimes people need to understand that about other portions of entertainment and TV, too, that just because we've seen it in a movie doesn't necessarily mean it's true.
Exactly. Now, is there anything else that you want to tell us about what you're working on?
Well, right now I'm focused on just on the piranha project. Obviously, in the past I've been involved with stuff with snakes and scorpions and things like that. So, I mean, I love all animals, but I've always had a certain soft spot for the more misunderstood. So I'm going to be busy doing that for the next little while, and who knows what happens after that. But if people want to visit my website, savethepiranhas.com, they can learn more about these misunderstood creatures, and there's also a Save the Piranhas Facebook group, so people are welcome to go on there and join and just show their support for these creatures. And as I said before, you know, I love all animals. Everything is here for a reason. They're all important. And a lot of people, you know, even in my travels I've met, they'll say they love animals, and then they're like, well, fish aren't really animals anyway, so, and things like that. So, I mean, I think we should love all animals, not just the cute and cuddly ones.
And I think especially fish, because we're pretty much depleting all of their population, and they're being hunted and eaten on the larger scale than land animals.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Thank you so much for the wonderful work you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So that was Matt Ellerback about piranhas. To find out more about his project, please visit savethepiranhas.com. And now I think we have Carissa for the events.
Yes. Tonight is Veggie Drinks Night at 3G Vegetarian Restaurant, and it's by candlelight. The restaurant is located at 3424 Canby Street at 18th Avenue in Vancouver, and it is Earth Saves Veggie Drinks Night. So it's a group of like-minded people, from vegans to carnivores, who get together to discuss animal rights and environmentalism. And then, as well, coming up on Sunday at Radha Yoga and Eatery, which is located at 728 Main Street in Vancouver as well, there is a local animal rights information hub, Who, What, Why, and How. Admission is $5, and the topic at hand will be a discussion of an online shared information hub, which is an idea that comes up repeatedly within Vancouver. There are many forums and calendars in existence already, but many are hardly ever used. So come and join other local area activists in discussing how a site such as this could work, who might use it, and how it might be developed. The more perspectives represented, the better. Liberation BC's monthly volunteer night is this coming Thursday, September 23rd, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Mount Pleasant Community Center, located at Kingsway and Main in Vancouver. Join us for an evening of letter writing, envelope stuffing, booklet labeling, and socializing. As an all-volunteer organization, your time contribution is vital in helping us get important work done for the animals. Each volunteer night includes a workshop that helps activists explore creative and effective ways of helping animals. For the September workshop, we are proud to bring you Leslie Fox, Executive Director of Fur Bearer Defenders. Leslie will be speaking with us about humane education and how to get animal rights into local schools. Leslie is a certified humane education specialist through the National Association for Humane and Environmental Education. As well, coming up next Saturday is the Walk for Farm Animals, also hosted by Liberation BC, which we've discussed previously on the show, and it takes place at the Vancouver Art Gallery on Georgia Street side. The registration starts at 12:30 and the walk begins at 1 p.m. Come to the Walk for Farm Animals. Bring noisemakers, kazoos, musical instruments, or your stilts. Let's get creative and fun for this cheerful event. The Walk is sponsored by local vegan store Carmivore, and if you haven't registered already, now is the time to start doing so. Start raising your money for the animals. Registration is $15 in advance or $20 on the day of the walk. To learn more about the Walk for Farm Animals, visit walkforfarmanimals.org. And if you have any questions, email vancouver@walkforfarmanimals.org or call Becky at 778-991-7615. Just a reminder that you are listening to the Animal Voices radio show on Co-op Radio 102.7 CFRO in Vancouver, BC, Canada.
Carissa?
Yes.
Thank you, Carissa. I wasn't on the air for like the first second. Thank you for that, Carissa. Yep. So I think our next guest is ready to join us. Marion Sullivan is a lawyer and an adjunct professor of animal law at Brooklyn Law School and Cardozo Law School. She's currently the chair of the American Bar Association's Tort Trial Insurance Practice Section Animal Law Committee. She is also the president of the New York City-based nonprofit, Our Hen House, which she runs with her partner, Jasmine Singer. Welcome to Animal Voices, Marianne.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's good to have you join us. I've been wanting to interview you for a long, long time.
Thank you.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about teaching animal law, because I don't think this is an area that people hear much about. You hear, you know, people going to law school for criminal law, corporate law, but not usually animal law. So do law...
No, well, I'm not... I'm not sure people go to law school for animal law, but over 100 law schools in the United States now have animal law classes, which is exciting, and it's a very recent development. And actually, people in law school usually don't specialize. It's a general degree, and people take subjects that interest them, and it's just nice that now one of the subjects can be animal law. I'm not sure that means too many of them are going to be finding careers, but hopefully they'll be doing some progressive work for animals.
Okay, so I guess it's not like you can just go to law school and become an animal rights lawyer and just do that.
Well, I guess you can, but you're going to have a hard time getting paid for it, which is the problem. Animals don't have too much money to go out and hire lawyers. There are, of course, I mean, there are animal protection organizations that hire lawyers, and those jobs are plums, and they're very highly sought after. Humane Society of the United States has a good-sized legal department, about 13, 15 lawyers, and the ASPCA has a nice-sized legal department, and many other organizations as well will have one or two lawyers. But, of course, those jobs are hard to get. But that doesn't mean that you can't practice animal law. There are some people who go into practice for themselves, and they do have paying clients. Usually they will have people who have companion animals, and they have problems with that, either housing problems or perhaps a dog bite issue, those kinds of issues. And some people make an actual full practice out of it or make it part of their practice.
Right.
And other people might be hired by animal protection organizations who want to hire outside counsel. So people do find ways to make some money at doing animal law. And another really important area is just pro bono.
Mm-hmm.
People may go into a very different area of law but still want to do some kind of pro bono for animals. And that's an enormous source of legal help for animals. So it's really important. So I think everybody who's going to law school is interested in animal law wants to find a law school that offers a course so they at least have a basic background of some of the issues.
Do you think animal law is being taken seriously by law schools?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, over 100 law schools have a course.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few law schools that have more than a course. I mean, Lewis and Clark in Portland, not too far from you, is really the leading law school in animal law in the United States. They have a whole program. They have a center for animal law, and they have a number of different courses, and they put on a big conference every year for law students and other people interested in animal law, which is coming up in October. They have a great program. A few other law schools also have actual programs in animal law more than just a single course. George Washington in D.C. and also Georgetown in D.C. both have a program in animal law, and there might be a few others as well that have more than one course, but loads of law schools have one course, and I think that, and that includes, you know, the big ones, Harvard, Yale, Columbia. So animal law has really gotten a strong foothold in American legal education, that's for sure.
That's really positive news to hear. Now, from my understanding, animals don't really have rights in our society, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think maybe that's why when we hear cases where animal abusers are prosecuted, they're usually charged for offenses like gun possession or environmental violations, but not cruelty to animals. Does this present a particular challenge for lawyers fighting for animals?
Well, fighting for animals is definitely a challenge, and sometimes it's a lot easier to prove other more crimes that are taken more seriously, and that's why such defendants will be charged with those crimes, because it's just easier for the prosecutor. Animal cruelty can be hard to charge, I mean, hard to prove. It would require a lot of evidence, and the laws are kind of ambiguous. It's not as clear what it will take to convict somebody. And in many places, animal cruelty is a misdemeanor. Well, most states in the United States have a felony animal cruelty provision, but the particular crime you're dealing with, the prosecutor is dealing with, may not fit into that provision. So they're dealing with a misdemeanor, and if they have some guy who's done, or gal, who's done some horrible thing, they don't want to charge them just with a misdemeanor. They want to charge them with the more serious crimes. And so it is true that a lot of people end up getting charged and convicted of the other crimes, and the animal issue gets put aside.
Right.
But I'm not sure it's, you know, the U.S., whether you're accurate saying animals have no rights, I mean, that's kind of a big question, and there's no clear answer. Animals certainly have laws protecting them, and whether that gives them rights or not is a question for philosophers, not for me. But there are those laws, and the laws do provide protection, but the laws are flawed. But it's not that animals are non-existent under the law. I wouldn't want anybody to think that. We do have laws to build on. We just have to make them better.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about current animal cruelty laws?
Yeah, cruelty laws are the basic law protecting animals in both the United States and in Canada, and they're very flawed, but they represent a good sense of how most people think about how animals should be protected. So in that sense, they do represent public sentiment. They usually balance the suffering of animal against human utility, and frequently that human utility will be a pretty high standard. You shouldn't cause animals to suffer unless it's necessary. But which, you know, I think probably expresses what a lot of people think about animals. But that's a very high standard, unless it's really necessary, such as if an animal is attacking you or whatever, right? Whatever necessity might arise, that you shouldn't harm the animal. But unfortunately, even though philosophically they kind of express a high position, they're not enforced in any way at all, because they're just so vague, necessary to whom and for what end, and they become, because they're not specifically spelled out what people are allowed to do and what people aren't allowed to do, as other criminal laws are, they end up being interpreted in very, very loose ways, and people end up not getting convicted. And this is particularly true when you're talking not about individualized cruelty, such as, you know, the guy who throws the dog off the high rise, which most people would find to be unnecessary because he's mad at his girlfriend or something. And those kind of cases do end up being adequately prosecuted under the cruelty law. But any kind of institutionalized cruelty, which, as we all know, is where most of the animals who are suffering in this world are suffering, it just escapes notice. I mean, that's not the only reason. The laws are flawed, and there's not an adequate prosecutorial staff. These laws are just enforced by the same prosecutors who enforce all other criminal laws, from murder to theft to burglary. And they're not going to give animal cruelty the same priority, and they don't even have the awareness of what it takes to prosecute an animal cruelty case or the resources. So there are many reasons these laws aren't adequately protecting animals, and they certainly aren't. But they are our basic law, and I think we should admire the sentiment behind them and try to build a more effective structure to adequately enforce them and to carry that sentiment out into reality.
Mm-hmm. And I guess what you just mentioned now is why people should learn more about animal law, and lawyers should get more interested, because there aren't really a lot of people interested in this area, so not a lot has there's not a lot to build on.
Right. Everybody who cares about animals should know more about animal law. And that doesn't mean they need to become a lawyer or go into this field, but they should know what the laws are protecting animals and how they think they need to be changed. I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm. Are there efforts in the U.S. To, you know, improve these laws or give animals more rights to make it possible to prosecute people who torture animals?
Well, I would say it's already possible to prosecute people who torture animals.
Okay.
Those are the kind of cases that do get prosecuted. Of course, they're still in the hands of regular prosecutors, and there's no private prosecution. Or just in one or two states is a very limited level of private prosecution. It's very rare. So it's really up to the local prosecutor. But those cases can get prosecuted. But I think in order to address the much bigger question of institutionalized cruelty, we really have to go beyond animal cruelty laws and create more administrative agencies that are in charge of taking care of animals. And to some extent we have the Animal Welfare Act in the United States, which is a federal law that protects animals in certain industry. Unfortunately, it's not very well enforced, and its provisions are not as high as most of us would want them to be.
Right.
But still, it is a good model for a law that can protect animals in industry, because it spells things out very specifically. So it's not up to some jury after the fact, did this industry treat animals cruelly or not. They are told right from the start, your cages have to be this big.
Right.
You have to provide food. You have to provide water. As I said, it's not the kind of treatment we would give to animals, but at least they're clear.
Mm-hmm.
The one problem, well, not the one problem, one of the problems with it, is that in the United States, it's very hard for individuals to sue the agency or to sue individuals, other individuals who are not following the law, because it's very hard, because you have to have legal standing in order to sue under an animal protection law like that. And very, very few people would be held to have standing, because they're not the ones who were injured. The animals were the ones who were injured. So as a result, unlike other administrative laws that are enforced by big federal agencies like the environmental laws, the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, and even the Endangered Species Act, which applies to animals, but only, you know, wild animals. Unlike those, nobody can ever get into court, and so there's this whole piece missing from the legal enforcement world. You have to have that third piece. You have the legislature pass this law that says everybody has to do this, and you have the administrative agency that wrote very specific regulations saying everybody has to do this, and you have the administrative agency to enforce that. But the third leg, which exists in other administrative areas, is that if the agency doesn't do a good job, then somebody can come in and sue them who's been hurt. But that doesn't exist for animals. And that's really the big hole through which a lot of animal protection law falls, that nobody can seem to get into court. And since the agency that does enforce our Federal Animal Welfare Act is the United States Department of Agriculture, you can imagine that it's not as well enforced as we would like it to be.
Wow, sounds like a huge problem we're tackling here.
Oh, it's big.
I feel tired just listening. How are we going to win this thing?
Well, you know that how bad, I mean, you're as familiar as anybody I know with how badly animals are treated in the world. And the law is what stands between anybody and cruelty and unfairness and mistreatment, and the law is not doing its job of standing between animals and those who would mistreat them. And the reason that things are so bad for animals in so many areas is that the law isn't doing its job. So it is a big job.
Now, in Canada, our animal welfare law is essentially 100 years old, and it hasn't really changed. And I think we probably have one of the worst in the world. But in the U.S., I've been hearing that things are progressing a little bit more rapidly. Just to talk about some good news, can you tell us a little bit about the recent reforms in California and Ohio and the impact you think the reforms will have on farmed animal welfare?
Yeah, this is where we're really having progress, is in the ballot initiative process. And I don't imagine there is a ballot initiative process in Canada.
No.
I don't think there is in too many countries.
No.
And it was, maybe 10, 15 years ago that the animal protection movement started to strategize about using this process. And it doesn't exist in every state. It's a state process, and it exists in, I think, less than half the states, or just about half. And some states have it, some states don't. It tends to be more the western states, but that's not universal. And in some states, citizens can just gather a certain number of signatures, and it's usually a great number of signatures, it's a big
mm-hmm.
job, and then get something on the ballot, a proposal on the ballot, and then have the citizens of the state vote on it. And as you can imagine, this has been a huge boon for animals, because people want animals to be better protected, and the reason that they're not is because the lobbyists are too powerful in the legislatures, and so nothing ever gets done. But when you actually leave it up to people themselves, they vote to improve the laws to protect animals. And it's a very time-consuming, extremely expensive process, but it has worked miracles. It really has. I mean, particularly in the farm animal front, though in other fronts as well.
Mm-hmm.
But starting in Florida, the gestation crate for pigs was banned, and then Arizona banned both the gestation crate for pigs and the veal crate for veal calves. And then in 2008, California banned the big three. Well, it passed a law. The citizens of California provided that not only veal calves and gestating pigs, and that's pregnant pigs, but also battery cage hens have to have enough room to turn around and spread their wings, and so essentially banning the battery cage system. And since then, other states where ballot initiatives either were planned or could have been held, the legislatures of those states have entered into negotiations with Humane Society of the United States, which has really been the leader of this
mm-hmm.
process, as well as Farm Sanctuary, and passed laws that most recently in Ohio. The laws haven't been passed there yet, but a deal was brokered, so we hope progressive laws will be passed, but in other states as well. So that has been very exciting. There will be a ballot initiative coming up in Missouri over puppy mills, Missouri being one of our biggest puppy mill states. So this has really been a huge boon to animals, and it not only is showing legal change, and these changes are both small and enormous. I
mm-hmm.
mean, they don't provide much for animals, but
right. When you put it in perspective, when you put it in perspective, when you think about it, right? Like, we're saying it's such a great progress, but they're only now given enough room to spread their wings, turn around, and lie down.
As I said, they're both tiny and enormous.
Mm-hmm.
The improvements are certainly not what any of us would provide to an animal. I mean, it's sad that we
mm-hmm.
think of this as a huge progress, but at the same time, after years of trying to make changes have started to be made, and we can only hope that this will be the beginning of other changes. At least there is a crack in the wall.
Right.
So we can, as I said, we can only hope that this is the beginning of more change, and it's certainly brought the issue to the attention of a great many people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the ballot initiative process, I think it's good to compare it to the Canadian process, because I'm not familiar with Canada's cruelty law, but I know that Canadian activists are very disturbed by it, and there has been a hard-fought battle for years
mm-hmm.
to to improve it. And it, you know, the farm lobby, it just stands in the way.
And
you cannot get things through the legislature.
Right. And again, to put things in perspective, how we're saying the changes are so tiny in the states, yet not a single municipality, not a single province in Canada has given animals, you know, enough room to turn around, to lie down, to spread their wings. And, you know, this is, when you think about it, the public is way ahead of the legislature. If you ask the public, everybody wants the animals they eat to be able to do that.
Absolutely. The public is, I mean, I think you have to be very careful when you do a ballot initiative not to go too far, because after putting several million dollars into it, you don't want to lose it. But so they tend to ask the absolute minimum.
Right.
I'm sure the public would go much further,
right.
But as I said, care has to be taken because mm-hmm. of the huge amount of effort and expense that goes into them. But the public isn't being paid by lobbyists. Go the other way, so that
right.
might explain that.
And, you know, outside of U.S. and Canada, there's been a lot of progress. For instance, in 2003, Israel outlawed the force feeding of birds on animal welfare grounds and, as a result, eradicated the foie gras industry. But when the HSUS won the case against Hudson Valley Foie Gras in New York, they couldn't even go after them for animal welfare violations, but had to go after them for water pollution. I was just wondering, what are your thoughts about the difference in how animal suffering is treated by the legal systems in U.S. and Israel?
Yeah, that's a really good comparison, because the Israeli case, which is a fabulous case, and people should really read it because it's a really interesting read. What I was talking about before, that it's so hard for American advocates to get into court on behalf of animals, does not exist in Israel. I mean, this doesn't have anything to do with their animal protection laws, but it's just, in general, under their general administrative law, it's just very much easier for anybody to get into court to complain about an administrative regulation. And they can certify anyone who has an interest, that they feel has an interest in the matter, to bring an action attacking a regulation. So it was actually the Supreme Court of Israel that made this decision. And it just shows, not only is the public ahead of the legislature, but I'm sure the courts would be too, because the courts should be enforcing the laws fairly. And if they are asked to look at these laws, I think that they would see the flaws in the way they are enforced. And that's the real problem, that we can't get into court. I think if we could, we'd be doing a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
But we really have that piece missing in our legal armory.
Right. Well, when you look back at the state of animal rights law 50 years ago in the U.S. and around the world, do you think we've come a long way?
I'm not sure I would say we've come a long way. Mm-hmm. I don't think there have been a lot of, I mean, certainly the ballot initiatives have been a change. And,
right.
But, you know, as we said, there's big change, but a small change, incredibly small in some ways. I think what I would like to think of is that we've come a long way in building a foundation for change, even
right.
though change hasn't really started to happen. It's, you know, like a building going up, like they work for years and you see nothing because they're building the foundation, then all of a sudden
right.
it goes up so quickly. I hope that's what we're doing now, is building that foundation for change and building a movement. I mean, everybody has, it's not just lawyers that have to care about this. Everybody has to care about changing the law for animals.
Right, and I guess the news are coming from other parts of the world. Again, in Spain in 2008, they extended basic human rights to great apes, and that was a great victory. And I guess the rights they got was the right to life, liberty, and freedom from physical and psychological torture. So, does that make you sad that animals don't just automatically have these rights, or does it make you glad that we're slowly recognizing that they should have these basic rights?
Well, I guess both.
Yeah.
You know, it is sad. I mean, it seems so obvious
yeah.
that animals should be entitled to this. And of course, it does tend to be the species like the great apes
right.
who are recognized. And I hope that the recognition of those animals will reach beyond just the great apes and help people to see that it's not just those animals that need these rights, but all animals.
Right.
And I hope that we get there, but we're a long way from there.
Right.
And that's not the idea that could happen here seems to me beyond belief. I hope I live to see that. But but that's certainly not the climate that we're in here. But it's so great when one country does it because it creates such a huge precedent.
And where do you think animal rights law will be in 50 years?
Well, I'm a basic pessimist, so you probably should ask me. Personally, I think we'll all be underwater in 50 years. I think that there are a few things that could change things dramatically. I mean, I certainly think that we're on the road to progressive change, and we are building a foundation for progressive change. I actually think the development of the in vitro meat, if it actually does reach the market, could change things a lot. Mm-hmm. I find it hard to believe that people are going to stop eating meat voluntarily.
Right.
But if meat is created that doesn't come from animals, I think that might change people's behavior. Maybe that's crazy, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I think that it's hard for me to believe that we will end animal agriculture, and with that, and I think that animal agriculture and meat eating is the big block that creates a block for other animals as well. People are just not willing to see them as living, breathing, sentient, caring, important creatures when they still eat them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we will have a lot more reforms. I certainly think we're headed in that direction, and things will get better. And people will have to stop eating less meat because I think that there's an increasing awareness of how bad it is for people. So I expect there to be reform, and possibly we will go to a situation where people will believe that animals have rights. I hope so. I don't have a lot of faith in the human race, so I don't know whether that's going to happen, but it's certainly something to fight for because it's so important.
Now, we only have about a minute left, and I want to talk about something a little bit happier. You were recently appointed the chair of American Bar Association's TIP Animal Law Committee. Can you tell us what you'll be doing in your new role?
Yeah, that's very exciting. This is a great committee, and it has members all over the country of people interested in animal law. I encourage any lawyers who are members of the ABA, or if you're not, join the ABA and become a member of the committee. We're doing some CLEs. We have a couple of teleconference CLEs coming up in the next few weeks, one on United States versus Stevens, which is the Kush video case, another on farm animal welfare and labeling. We'll be doing other CLEs are continuing legal education programs. We're trying to do more online information resources for people interested in animal law. We have a great Facebook page. Please become you like it, you don't become a fan anymore. Please like it. It's the Animal Law Committee of the TIPS, of the American Bar Association Tort Trial Insurance Practice. It's a long section, but you can find it, I'm sure.
Great.
And I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
And we'll be doing hopefully some podcasts, and we're working on a toolkit, an online toolkit for people in animal law. So we really want to be the go-to place for all different lawyers of all different stripes interested in different issues in animal law, coming from different perspectives, and trying to bring people together to help create progressive change. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, that sounds very exciting. We're all out of time now, but thank you so much for joining us, Marianne.
Thank you.
Take care.
It was really fun.
Yes, I had fun too. See you next time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Marianne Sullivan, animal rights lawyer, professor, and president of Our Hen House. To find out more about Marianne and her work, please visit ourhenhouse.org. And that was the Animal Voices Radio Show. I'm your co-host, Joanne Chang, and see you next week.
Bye.